2022. The role of disinformation and intelligence potential in the realization of the communist strategies. The disinformation program has played a significant role in the successful realization of the communist strategies. A study of the available communist and Western evidence reveals the existence of at least six interlocking strategies for the furtherance of communism along the lines dictated by this long-range policy. The first strategy relates to the activities of communist parties in the advanced industrial countries. Its essence is the use of various tactics, such as Eurocommunism, the deliberate display of an image of a responsible, independent party to establish unity of action with social democrats and Catholics in Europe and to create a neutral socialist Europe tilted toward the communist side. The strategy envisages three periods. In the first period, the communists seek temporary allies among the social democrats, the trade unionists, and the Catholics, including the moderates and the conservatives who could be brought into play against any alliance with the United States. In the second period, the conservatives are eliminated and the social democrats become the principal allies in a neutral socialist Europe. In the final period, the communists take the necessary steps for the complete takeover. The second strategy deals with the communist effort to establish unity of action with the developing countries of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Its essence is the use of various tactics, including the support of the national liberation movements by the USSR and other communist countries and capitalizing on the late Tito's influence in the non-aligned movement, which has served to lessen Western influence in these areas. The third strategy is concerned with the effort to reverse the military balance of power, which in 1960 was tilted heavily in favor of the West. The essence of this strategy is revealed by a number of communist actions, including diplomatic negotiations, like SALT, a Chinese effort to make a false military alliance with the United States, efforts to increase Soviet military potential, involving the United States in an unpopular war like that in Vietnam, anti-military campaigns in Western Europe, and terrorist acts against U.S. military officials. The fourth strategy deals with the undermining of the ideological resistance of the non-communist world to the advance of communism. Its essence is not in the use of propaganda and the preaching of ideology, but by concrete actions and deeds, including calculated anti-Sovietism. Underlying all of these strategies is the fifth strategy, that of the disinformation program. The most important element of this program is the calculated Sino-Soviet split, which has enabled the two communist powers to pursue successfully the scissors strategy, that is, having complementary dual foreign policies, the close coordination of which is concealed from the West and which has thus far escaped detection by the West. It is this scissors strategy that has contributed significantly to all the other strategies. Although the communists have achieved unity of action with some Arab and African states and have generated anti-military campaigns in Western Europe, they have failed to reach the majority of social democrats, the free trade unions, and the Catholics there. They were also unsuccessful in the United States largely because of the strong anti-communist position of the American labor movement under the late George Meany. The formation of united fronts in Latin America as a whole has been inhibited by the strength of military influence in the continent. The major strategy. The sixth strategy, however, is the most significant. This strategy, which has been in preparation by the Bloc for the past 20 years, deals with the solutions of the remaining problems with the unity of action and has a crucial role in the final phase of the long-range policy. This last strategy relates to the consistent effort to bring about a political and economic consolidation of individual communist regimes, the construction of so-called mature communist societies, and the preparation of a semblance of democratization in order to provide, in Togliatti's words, support for the communists outside the bloc in realization of the major strategies. In essence, this strategy involves the interaction of the following factors. 1. The development of an effective political, economic, diplomatic, and military substructure under which the communists can continue to coordinate their policies and actions on a bilateral basis through a system of friendship treaties. This substructure would not be affected by the formal dissolution of the Warsaw Pact. A significant role in this coordination will rest with the party apparatuses, especially with the departments responsible for relations with the bloc countries. 2. The making of creative ideological readjustments and the revitalization of the communist parties and the mass organizations, including the trade unions and the youth and intellectual organizations. Further, the broadening of the political base of the parties and the development of the mass organizations into effective substructures of the parties. Such changes will make possible the introduction of controlled political opposition, which will provide the basically totalitarian regimes with a convincing impression of a fundamental change and a semblance of democracy. For example, within a 20-year period, the Communist parties of the USSR and China almost doubled their memberships to 17 million and 36 million, respectively. In China, this was accomplished during and after the Cultural Revolution. A major role in this revitalization was played by the ideological commissions and the cultural departments of the parties. 3. The preparation of a false opposition. During the introduction of controlled democratization in the communist regimes, for the purpose of creating a favorable condition for unity of action with the social democrats, the free trade unions, and with the Catholics against NATO and the U.S. military-industrial complex. This preparation was revealed by the reorganization and reorientation of the KGB and the security services of the bloc countries, as ordered by Shelepin. The rationale was to coordinate their joint efforts and to introduce a false, controlled opposition along the lines of the Soviet experience with the false anti-communist organization Trust during the NEP under Lenin. Shelepin specifically ordered that agents of influence be used among prominent writers, scientists, trade unionists, nationalists, and religious leaders. He emphasized the need to use agents of influence among the heads of the various religions, including the head of the Russian Orthodox Church and the Muslim leaders in Soviet Central Asia, for political objectives. A significant and active role in such preparations is played by the administrative departments of the communist parties, which supervise the activities of the security services. 4. The development of an effective strategic coordination between the ministries of foreign affairs, ambassadors, communist parties, and mass organizations of the communist countries within the bloc and also of the communist parties outside the bloc. A significant role in such coordination belongs to the party departments of international relations and to communist diplomats. This explains why some communist ministers, such as those from Romania, Hungary, and Bulgaria, were in the past the heads of such departments. A significant role in such coordination, specifically for the realization of the strategy in Western Europe, rests with the Soviet Committee for European Security, headed by party official V. Shidikov. This committee was created in June 1971 for better coordination between the Soviet mass organizations and the struggle for the realization of a collective European security. The development and realization of the strategy is revealed by the numerous conferences of communist parties, especially in Moscow and Prague in 1965, and the high-level meetings of communist leaders with Brezhnev in the Crimea during the 1970s. The study of available evidence leads to the conclusion that the Czechoslovakian democratization in 1968 was a rehearsal of this strategy to see how this scenario can work in practice and to test the Western reaction to it. The disinformation and strategic role of Yugoslavia. The new methodology makes it possible to see how the so-called independence of Yugoslavia has enabled her to play a leading part in promoting the success of communist Third World strategy. Yugoslavia was well qualified to bring her influence to bear in organizing the Third World, reorientating it towards socialism, and forging it into a weapon for use against the West. It was Tito who drew Khrushchev's attention to the political potentialities of friendship and cooperation with such leaders as Nasser, Nehru, and Sukarno. The reconciliation between Yugoslavia and the other communist countries and Yugoslavia's contribution and commitment to the long-range policy of 1958-60 were successfully concealed by disinformation. They have remained hidden for the past 20 years, despite the vast amount of evidence that can be interpreted as indicating the fulfillment by Yugoslavia of a strategic role in coordination with the other members of the communist bloc, above all, with those in Africa, Asia, and the United Nations. Yugoslav influence inside and outside the non-aligned movement was acceptable to the neutralist and nationalist Third World leaders largely because they saw Yugoslavia, like themselves, as independent and, unlike the great powers, disinterested in dominating and controlling them. The Yugoslav brand of communism seemed more flexible and adaptable than the Soviet or Chinese version. Moreover, the penetration of Yugoslav ideas into the Third World was accomplished not through the traditional activities of a tightly knit communist party, but through personal influence and such mass organizations as the Socialist Alliance of the Working People of Yugoslavia and the Yugoslav Trade Unions. On important issues, Tito's line was consistently anti-Western and helpful to the fulfillment of long-range communist policy. He took up an anti-American position in the Cuban crisis of 1962. He followed the pro-Arab communist line in 1967 and broke off diplomatic relations with Israel. He worked hard to persuade the non-aligned nations to follow suit. In 1973, 18 African states broke off relations with Israel. Tito followed the communist line on the recognition of East Germany and influenced many Arab and African states in the same direction. He mobilized the non-aligned nations in condemning American intervention in Vietnam. He criticized American behavior over the civil war in Angola in 1975, and for a while the Ford administration reconsidered its attempts to improve relations with Yugoslavia. Tito was critical of Cuban actions in Africa and of Soviet intervention in Afghanistan, but many of his criticisms were muted and none led to any effective action. Tito and his Yugoslav colleagues can take a major share of the credit for the swing in the United Nations balance over the last 20 years against the West and in favor of the communist bloc. A further point, with important implications for the final phase of long-range communist policy, is that Tito succeeded in winning the support and solidarity of many European and Japanese socialists for Third World National Liberation movements. To sum up, Yugoslav actions from 1958 to 1980 were closely coordinated with the Soviet Union and, latterly, with China. Through the use of disinformation on Yugoslav independence, which was accepted equally by the Third World and the West, Yugoslavia was able to play a major strategic role on Leninist lines in promoting united action with the Third World countries, in reorientating them towards socialism, and in converting them into allies of communism against the West. Tito well deserved the Order of Lenin he was awarded in 1979. He is dead, but his policies continue. Because of Western failure to see through disinformation, including the violent Chinese and Albanian attacks on Tito for acting as an agent of United States imperialism in Africa, the United States and her allies have continued to regard Yugoslavia as an asset for the West and a moderating force in the newly independent countries. They have continued to accord her favorable treatment. Sino-Soviet disinformation and the Cultural Revolution, a new interpretation. Soviet denunciation of the Cultural Revolution as anti-Marxist and anti-socialist helped to conceal its true meaning as part of the process of Chinese communist reconstruction. At the same time, the Chinese leaders were able to exploit their alleged differences with the Soviets to rally the party and the masses behind them during their most vulnerable period by hoisting the flag of Chinese nationalism. In this, they were repeating Stalin's exploitation of capitalist encirclement of the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 1930s to rally the Russian people to the Soviet regime. The difference in the Chinese case was that, deliberately deceiving their own population and the outside world, the Chinese included the Soviet Union among the imperialist powers attempting to encircle China. In so doing, they served their own interests in strengthening and stabilizing their regimes. At the same time, they served the strategic interests of long-range bloc policy. Turmoil there undoubtedly was during the Cultural Revolution, but in the light of the new methodology, the facts are capable of a new interpretation. The Cultural Revolution was a part, and a very significant part, of the wider process of the communist reconstruction of Chinese society. It followed, as the next logical step, the reconstruction of Chinese agriculture. The newly established material basis of Chinese society required an appropriate Marxist political and ideological superstructure. For this reason, Mao called it the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. Apart from causing widespread economic dislocation, the creation of communes and the switch in priority back from industry to agriculture exposed the inadequacy of the structure and character of the existing party and its mass organizations. These were based mainly in the cities, whereas the real Chinese masses were in the countryside, hence the drive to send intellectuals to the villages. The ideological level of the party was too low, and the tendency toward rigid, bureaucratic inertia was unacceptable. The decision was therefore taken to regroup the most highly indoctrinated and militant elements of the old party and youth organization into an alternative structure relying largely on the army and Ministry of Public Security to provide the necessary element of control and to prevent the situation from getting out of hand. The appearance of political departments, detachments of Red Guards, and revolutionary committees was not spontaneous. It was instigated by the Central Committee. Not until essential preparations had been made on this basis for the introduction of an alternative power structure was the Cultural Revolution launched. With an alternative power structure in being, it was possible to abolish large parts of the existing party organization below the Central Committee level while huge numbers of party officials were being re-indoctrinated. Meanwhile, the alternative organization, drawn largely from the younger generation, set about its task of increasing its ties with and influence over the masses in order to fire them with revolutionary ardor and commit them to the policies of communist reconstruction. The Cultural Revolution was initiated by the plenum of the Central Committee in August 1966 and was guided and directed by the Central Committee throughout. That it was a revolution controlled from above was shown by its temporary interruption for the spring sowing season in 1967 and the simultaneous resumption of classes and schools on the Central Committee's instructions. The revolution, being ideological, was naturally directed by the Central Committee's ideologists, led by Chin Pata and Mao himself. By April 1969, sufficient progress had been made for the Cultural Revolution proper to be damped down by the Ninth Party Congress. Although the turmoil died away, many of the processes begun before and during the Cultural Revolution continued. If the essence of the Cultural Revolution period from 1966 to 1969 was the creation of new organs of power and the attack by the leftists on the rightists, then the essence of the following 3 years was the reabsorption of the older, re-educated party officials into the new organs of power and the attack on leftists, initially begun with the support of the army, which was then itself brought under firmer party control. The first signs of détente with the West began to appear. In the next 3 years, from 1973 to 1976, under the alleged guidance of the Gang of Four, the process of re-education continued. But now it was a more specific process of ideological and political preparation of the reconstructed party, government apparatus, and mass organizations for the new situation entailed by a shift to activist, détente diplomacy. With the death of Mao and the return of the pragmatists to power, full-scale, activist détente diplomacy was launched on Soviet lines with the aim of using economic, financial, and technological help from the non-communist world to accelerate China's economic and military development. China was ready to play her full part in long-range bloc policy. She sought to align herself especially with conservatives in the advanced countries and Islamic regimes in the Third World, in order the more effectively to carry out the Sino-Soviet scissors strategy. As in other communist countries, the process of communist reconstruction in China has been accompanied by the introduction of new, and the revival of old, techniques. In China's case, the aims were to revitalize the Communist Party, to broaden its political base, to commit the younger generation to ideological objectives, to re-educate the older generation of party members, to control and neutralize internal opposition, to revitalize the state apparatus and armed services, and to prepare China as a whole for its part in the implementation internally and externally of long-range bloc policy. The techniques of political activism, provocation, disinformation, and political prophylaxis, which have been described in detail in the case of the Soviet Union, have all been used effectively in China. The alleged struggles for power in China between leftists and rightists, dogmatists and pragmatists, are as unreal as the struggles between Stalinists and anti-Stalinists in the Soviet Union. Cooperation within the leadership to create the illusion of struggles between themselves or between the party and the army helps to forestall the threat of real struggles within the leadership or of tendencies to putschism in the army. It gives the party ideologists material to train party officials in fighting undesirable tendencies while at the same time preparing them for radical shifts in policy. The violence of the shifts in the Chinese line is a technique borrowed from that used by Stalin at the end of the NEP period. Stalin's shifts from left to right and back again were used to forge the party into a hardened instrument obedient to his will. The difference lies in the fact that Stalin used the technique to establish his personal dictatorship and the factionalism was real. The Chinese leadership used it to increase the effectiveness of the party as a whole and the factionalism in the leadership was faked. The recent reassessment and partial downgrading of Mao in China presents parallels with the Stalinization in the Soviet Union and is designed in part to forestall the emergence in the future of any tendencies toward personal dictatorship in the CPC. The formation of the Red Guards recalls the use of Komsomol activists in the Soviet Union during Stalin's collectivization of agriculture in the 1930s. The technique of using wall posters by the regime seems to have been borrowed from their use by the genuine opposition in 1956-57. The Cultural Revolution and the whole process of Chinese communist reconstruction have followed Lenin's precepts on overcoming infantile disorder and isolation of the party from the masses. The re-education of cadres and the restructuring of the party and its youth and trade union organizations were necessary both to achieve these aims and to prepare the Chinese system for activist détente with the West as the long-range policy unfolded. Despite the alleged destruction of the party in the Cultural Revolution, in fact it strengthened itself. The Chinese trade union, youth, and women's organizations have resumed their activities. As a result of stabilization and the reinforcement of the party and its mass organizations, the Chinese, like other communist states after 1960, were enabled to introduce NEP-style measures, including some of the appurtenances of democracy, such as wall posters, trials, the release of market forces, and the relaxation of controls over religion, intellectual life, working conditions in factories, and property ownership. Dissidents began to appear on the Soviet pattern. Broader contacts were allowed with the West and more attention was paid to TRFC overseas Chinese, whose relatives in China are said to number 12 million. Sino-Soviet duality and communist strategy in the Third World. Seen in the light of the new methodology, the Chinese effort in the Third World is complementary to that of the other communist states and an important element in communist strategy as a whole. The character of the Chinese effort in the Third World from 1958 onward was dictated by China's historical background and current capacities. China had been freed from colonial oppression by a prolonged liberation struggle with Japan. The Chinese party had learned how to exploit conditions of military conflict to deepen its influence and win power. As a rule, Chinese and Soviet efforts can be seen in terms not of rivalry, but of a coordinated division of labor that has brought dividends for the common strategy. Where a serious dispute exists between two Third World countries, a pattern in Soviet and Chinese policies can be discerned in which the Soviet Union and China take up opposite sides and adopt a clear-cut duality in their policies. The Soviet Union seeks to build up its influence with one party to the dispute and China with the other. The classic example of this pattern is to be seen in the case of India and Pakistan. The Sino-Indian conflict of 1962 was provoked by the Chinese. The Soviets took a broadly anti-Chinese and pro-Indian line that gained them goodwill in India. At the time of the outbreak of open Sino-Soviet party polemics in 1963, an Indian Army and Air Force mission visited the Soviet Union. In the following year, the Indian Defense Minister went to Moscow to discuss Soviet-Indian military cooperation. Further exchanges of military delegations took place in 1967 and 1968. In the mid-1960s, regular consultations on problems of mutual interest were instituted between the Soviet and Indian foreign ministries. Point one, the United States held India responsible for the Indo-Pakistani conflict in 1971 and terminated military aid to India. The Soviets called for a cessation of the conflict, but nevertheless gave the Indians moral support, for which Mrs. Gandhi expressed her gratitude. A treaty of friendship was signed between the Soviet Union and India in August 1971. An influx of Soviet visitors followed. In October, Fira Yubin went to India, interestingly enough in the same month as Tito. He was followed in the next 3 months by the Chief of Soviet Military Aviation, Kutikov, and the Deputy Foreign Minister, V. Kuznetsov. In December, Mrs. Gandhi condemned American policy in Vietnam. Point two, in 1973, an agreement was signed for cooperation between Gosplan, the Soviet planning agency, and the Indian Planning Commission. Point three, largely because of skillful Soviet exploitation of the conflict between India and Pakistan. By the mid-1970s, the trend toward closer Soviet-Indian relations had become virtually irreversible. The Desai government was unable to stem the tide. Relations were further cemented by Brezhnev's visit and talks with Mrs. Gandhi in 1981. While the Soviets were strengthening their hold in India, the Chinese were doing the same in Pakistan, using the same techniques of exchanges of visits and military delegations, especially during the years 1962-67. When the United States ceased military aid to Pakistan in 1967, the Chinese stepped theirs up. In 1968, President Yahya Khan and his foreign minister visited China. Further cooperation developed. In 1970, Quamojo visited Pakistan. Pakistan was sufficiently close to China to be used as an intermediary in arranging the visit of Kissinger to China in 1971. Bhutto was received by Mao in 1972 after the further conflict with India and the formation of Bangladesh. The conflict resulted in Pakistan's departure from the British Commonwealth and CEDAW. Further high-level exchanges of visits continued between Pakistan and China, regardless of changes in the Pakistani government. As in the case of Soviet influence in India, Chinese influence in Pakistan is creating conditions for an alliance between them and for an eventual communist takeover. A situation already exists that can be further exploited by calculated and coordinated Soviet and Chinese moves, for example, in connection with the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan. The recent Chinese moderation is intended to help build up the new image of respectability required by the Chinese for their détente diplomacy vis-à-vis the advanced industrial, as well as third world, countries. It is also consistent with the emerging pattern of Sino-Soviet duality. While the Soviet Union builds up united fronts with nationalists against the United States, China seeks to ensnare the United States and other conservative countries, including the Asian and African states, in artificial, treacherous alliances with herself and her associates, ostensibly against the Soviet Union. In this way, China seeks to enter her enemy's camp not merely unopposed, but welcomed as an ally against Soviet expansionism and equipped with Western arms. In the present phase of policy, neither the Soviet Union nor China puts local communist parties in general in the forefront as strategic weapons. When the objective of isolating the United States from the Third World has been achieved, local communist parties will come into their own and accounts will be settled with nationalists who have suppressed them in the past. Sino-Soviet duality and military strategy. The new methodology illuminates the contribution to the success of communist strategies made by the division of labor between the Soviets and Chinese and the coordinated duality of their policies. In the early years of détente, paraphrasing Lenin's words, the Chinese were given a terrible double bass to play in contrast with the Soviets' sentimental violin. While the Soviets were emphasizing détente and peaceful coexistence and taking up high-level contacts with American and European leaders, the Chinese advocated militant and violent revolution. Marked divergences appeared in the treatment in the Soviet and Chinese press of Khrushchev's visit to the United States in 1959. In February 1960, 3 months before the abortive summit meeting in Paris, the Chinese delegate at the Warsaw Pact conference criticized the Soviets for their rapprochement with the imperialists, who had refused to make concessions on Berlin. On the eve of Khrushchev's meeting with the French president in April 1960, the Chinese press resumed its criticism of the Yugoslav revisionists and published articles calling for a militant, revolutionary approach to world problems, while the Soviet press continued to emphasize moderation and peaceful coexistence. Further divergences appeared in Soviet and Chinese handling of the Cuban and Sino-Indian crises in 1962. But perhaps the most striking instance of duality in the early 1960s occurred during the Soviet-American-British negotiations on the Atomic Test Ban Treaty in 1963. The arrival in Moscow of the Anglo-American delegation that was to conduct those negotiations was immediately preceded by the arrival of a Chinese delegation that was to conduct party negotiations with the CPSU. Soviet warmth toward the Western delegations contrasted sharply with their coolness toward the Chinese. Progress on the test ban talks was accompanied by the apparent failure of the Sino-Soviet negotiations. The signature of the test ban treaty was followed by interruption of the Sino-Soviet talks, attacks in the Chinese press on Soviet policy in the test ban negotiations, and open polemics between the Soviet and Chinese parties. A further eruption of Sino-Soviet polemics occurred before the Soviet-American negotiations on a nuclear non-proliferation treaty in 1966-67. Subsequent events have shown just how little foundation there was for Chinese accusations that the Soviets had capitulated to Western imperialism in the 1960s and had sacrificed socialist solidarity and support for revolutionary struggle on the altar of peaceful coexistence. Point four, the effect of these Chinese accusations at the time was to promote Western illusions about Soviet moderation, and thus to create favorable conditions for the success of Soviet activist diplomacy toward the United States and European NATO powers. In contrast with the implacable Chinese dogmatists, the Soviets appeared cautious, reasonable, non-ideological, pragmatic communists with whom it was possible to negotiate a deal. Furthermore, they appeared sincere in their claim to have a common interest with the West in restraining Chinese influence. Sino-Soviet duality produced the effect on the West that the communist strategists intended. It seems safe to say that it brought them substantial dividends. For example, had it not been for General de Gaulle's belief in the sincerity of Soviet interest in détente and his confidence in the authenticity of the Sino-Soviet split, it is more than doubtful that he would have gone as far as he did in his dealings with the Soviet Union, his recognition of communist China, and his withdrawal of France from its military commitments to NATO. From 1958 to 1969, despite all the sound and fury, China, by comparison with the Soviet Union, was passive diplomatically in relation to the Western powers. The contrast was only natural. The Soviet Union was already a military superpower engaged in strategic competition with the United States and NATO. The Soviets had a solid background of experience in dealing with the Western powers and a well-trained staff to carry out their policies. China was militarily insignificant, unrecognized by the United States and many other countries, and short of trained and indoctrinated diplomatic staff. The onset of the Cultural Revolution brought a further retreat into diplomatic isolation. In 1969, all this began to change. With the completion of the Cultural Revolution, China re-emerged onto the international scene. Chinese activist détente diplomacy was launched. Trade, and especially the acquisition of advanced technology, bulked large among the obvious Chinese motives. In January 1969, a special West German ambassador, Egon Bahr, was invited to conduct trade negotiations in Shanghai. Exchanges of visits between Chinese and Western statesmen and military leaders became commonplace. A drive to obtain diplomatic recognition soon brought results. By 1970, it had been granted by 55 countries. On October 25, 1971, Communist China was seated in the United Nations. By 1973, it had diplomatic relations with 91 countries. In February 1972, after two preparatory visits by Kissinger carried out initially in great secrecy and without consultation with the Japanese, the most directly concerned of America's close allies, President Nixon visited China. He was followed by the British Foreign Secretary, Douglas Home, by President Pompidou of France in 1973, and by the West German Chancellor, Schmidt, in 1975. The German and British conservative opposition leaders, Strauss and Thatcher, visited in 1975 and 1977 respectively, and the British Foreign Secretary, Crossland, in 1976. In return, Chinese ministerial visits were paid to the United States and Europe, culminating in Deng Xiaoping's visit to the United States and Japan and Chairman Hua's journey through Europe in 1979. In the same year, the U.S. President's National Security Advisor, Brzezinski, visited China, followed in the aftermath of Soviet intervention in Afghanistan by the Defense Secretary, Brown. The exchanges of visits between China and the United States, Western Europe, and Japan reflected not only the development of trade with, and credits for, China, but also the transfer of Western technology for China's industrial modernization and rearmament. 3 points about Chinese activist diplomacy deserve to be singled out for special emphasis. First, it has been continuously and consistently maintained throughout the 1970s despite the death of Mao in 1976. Chairman Hua said as much himself on December 25, 1976, when he undertook that China would carry out the directives worked out by Chairman Mao. 5. Second, a preeminent role has been played by Deng Xiaoping. Under Mao's guidance, one of the principal Chinese architects of the long-range policy of 1958-60. Third, a noticeable feature of the Chinese choice of Western leaders suitable for cultivation, more readily explained in terms of strategy than ideological affinity, has been the proportion of conservatives among them. Some of them, Strauss, Brzezinski, and Thatcher, for example, were singled out as targets for personal attacks by the Soviets, attacks that did nothing to harm their relations with the Chinese. At the same time as the Chinese were embarking on a policy of détente, the Soviets were building on the successes of their activist diplomacy in the earlier 1960s. Their efforts followed the three principal directions described above: SALT talks with the United States, CSC in Europe, and closer bilateral relationships with certain European powers. Also, at the same time, the West began to realize that the Soviet Union had taken advantage of détente to build up its military strength. Seen in the light of the new methodology, the stepping up of Sino-Soviet border hostilities in 1969 and 1970 was not fortuitous. Neither was the adoption by the Soviets and Chinese of diametrically opposite positions on many other issues. Duality in Sino-Soviet policies served to provide a favorable background for the launching and conduct of both the SALT negotiations and Chinese activist détente diplomacy. As far as CSC was concerned, it was noticeable that the Chinese, while condemning the Soviets for their part in organizing the Helsinki conferences, nevertheless lent their support to the concept of a Western Europe, independent of the two superpowers, in other words, to the intermediate aim of overall communist strategy for Europe. As the 1970s wore on and as Soviet aggressiveness became more apparent in Europe, Africa, and finally Afghanistan, China began to look attractive as a potential ally for the West. The common interest between the Soviet Union and the West in resisting Chinese militancy in the 1960s had been superseded by a common interest between China and the West in resisting Soviet expansionism in the 1970s. West European and Japanese capitalists tumbled over one another to build up China's economic and military potential, egged on by anti-Soviet conservative Western politicians and experts on defense. Alliance with China seemed to offer the best hope of redressing the growing military imbalance between the Soviet Union and the West, especially in Europe. The United States has been more and more disposed to play the China card. The relationship with Communist China, initiated under Nixon and Kissinger and developed under Carter and Brzezinski, was carried to the point of military cooperation under Reagan and Haig, with the intention of building up China as a counterweight to the Soviet Union. Both in relation to the Soviets in the 1960s and to the Chinese in the 1970s and 1980s. The West has forgotten the error of the German General Staff in helping to rearm the Soviet Union after the Treaty of Rapallo in 1922. The Sino-Soviet scissors strategy has not been recognized for what it is. In short, first the Soviet Union and then China carried out the classical strategic precept of seeking to enter the enemy's camp unopposed and, if possible, welcomed by him. As Sun Tzu said, to subdue the enemy without fighting is the acme of skill. Fighting between communist states is generally regarded as conclusive evidence of a split between them. But it should be remembered that the conflicts in the Sino-Soviet and Sino-Vietnamese border areas have taken place in the presence of few, if any, Western observers. Border incidents are easily staged and open radio communication about them can be used in support of their authenticity. Joint exercises can be made to look very much like battles. Even if genuine damage and casualties are caused, incidents are still open to more than one interpretation. Apparent fighting between communist states can contribute to such specific communist strategic objectives as promoting agreements and false alignments between communist and non-communist states. For example, the Sino-Vietnamese war and fears that it might spread. Intensified Western pressure on the United States to conclude the SALT II agreement with the Soviet Union and helped make China look attractive as a potential Western ally against the Soviet Union. Sino-Soviet duality and the revolutionary movement. The Sino-Soviet split did not in general have the effect that might have been expected of splitting the non-bloc communist parties down the middle nor has it reduced their influence. Most of the West European parties became more active and remained broadly in alignment with the Soviets. Their association with Soviet moderation helped their images and improved their chances of success with United Front tactics. The Italian party was far more influential in 1980 than it had been in 1960. In France, the Socialist-Communist alliance came closer to an electoral victory in 1974 than at any moment since the Second World War. Insofar as pro-Chinese splinter groups broke away from mainline communist parties, as in Belgium, for example, it was in general advantageous to long-range communist strategy. A calculated shedding of the most radical and violent revolutionary elements helped the communist parties to improve their images as respectable democratic parties and potential allies of socialist, Christian, and other progressive groups. The Japanese party tried to take advantage of the Sino-Soviet split to broaden its political influence. Chinese militancy and Sino-Soviet duality opened up possibilities of united action between pro-Chinese and other extreme-left factions, especially Trotskyites. In June 1963, coinciding with the outbreak of open polemics between the Soviet and Chinese parties, the Trotskyite Fourth International, in a special resolution, approved the historic task of joining the Chinese and fighting for the creation of a united front between the Fourth International and the Chinese comrades. In 1967, the Fourth International declared itself in favor of accelerating the revolutionary armed struggle of the masses in the main bases of capitalism. The majority supported Mao. A minority group, critical of some of Mao's ideas, proposed a more flexible line in fighting communist parties. The Ninth Congress of the Fourth International was held at Rimini in April 1969. It discussed tactics in Latin America. The European section of the majority group held a conference in October 1969 and decided to cease attempts to penetrate communist parties and to create independent revolutionary parties. In the same month, the Congress of the Minority Group in Vienna approved the actions of splinter groups in the communist movement. At the same time, it condemned refusal by these splinter groups to cooperate with the Soviet Union in support of the liberation struggle in Vietnam. Also in 1969, as the movement for CSC was gathering momentum, Trotskyist meetings and protests against NATO were held in England, Denmark, Japan, and Australia. The information publicly available is insufficient to allow judgment on the degree to which the activities of extreme-left radical groups have been successfully coordinated under Chinese or Soviet influence. But the rivalry, and sometimes even violence, between these groups and the mainline Communist Party should not be allowed to obscure the extent to which the activities of all of them have served the aims of long-range communist strategy and might serve, so even more in critical situations in the future. Ponomarev, while describing some of the elements of the New Left in 1971 as adventurous, concluded that to neglect this segment of the mass movement would mean to weaken the stress of the anti-imperialist struggle and hinder the creation of a united front against monopolistic capitalism. 7. Broadly speaking, since the adoption of the long-range policy and the development of Sino-Soviet duality, both the moderate communist parties and the radical, revolutionary, and terrorist groups have succeeded in gathering strength, often at the expense of genuine left-wing and democratic socialist movements. In the early 1960s, the International Front organizations provided a convenient forum for the experimental airing of Sino-Soviet differences. The repudiation of radical Chinese positions by these organizations helped make them less disreputable and, at the same time, apparently confirmed the authenticity of the Sino-Soviet dispute. When in the mid-1960s the Chinese finally withdrew from the front organizations, they made no serious attempt to disrupt them or to form rival counterparts of their own. The Chinese withdrawal seems to have been entirely logical. In part, it may have been dictated by the Cultural Revolution. It was no doubt also motivated by a desire neither to split nor to demoralize the organizations as they geared themselves up for their strategic role. It also left the Chinese free to pursue unorthodox tactics, including friendly relationships with conservative governments, without risk of compromising and confusing the faithful in the front organization's ranks. The advantages of Sino-Soviet duality. To sum up, the coordinated duality of Soviet and Chinese policies offers a number of advantages for communist strategy. It enables the communist bloc to retain the initiative, to open up new possibilities for maneuver, and to induce erroneous responses from its opponents. Where there are conflicts in the outside world, it enables the two communist partners, by taking opposite sides, to strengthen communist influence simultaneously over both parties to the dispute. It enables one partner to operate effectively in areas from which the other is excluded or deliberately excludes itself for tactical reasons. It facilitates a division of labor between the two partners and enables one to take unorthodox or provocative action without compromising the other. In the longer run, through enabling the Chinese to express hostility to the Soviet Union and emphasize their concern with Chinese national interests, it may well help China to appeal more effectively to the overseas Chinese. Finally, it offers possibilities of inducing conservatives in both advanced and third world countries to compromise themselves by entering in good faith into treacherous alliances and alignments through which they can be discredited in the final phase of policy. As a strategic weapon, duality may prove itself to be more effective than either war or the export of revolution. The intelligence potential and agents of influence. The implementation of the disinformation program can be fully understood only if one takes into account the use by the communists of their intelligence potential, especially agents of influence both in the West and in the communist bloc. Because precise information is normally lacking, surveys of communist influence in particular countries or areas seldom take into account the assets of the communist intelligence services. From his service in Finland at the time of the launching of the long-range policy, the author knows that these assets can prove to be a major factor in the internal political situation of a non-communist country. They can contribute effectively to the furtherance of communist strategy. In the 1950s and 1960s, the Soviet government, acting largely through the Soviet intelligence service, exercised great pressure on the older anti-communist generation of Finnish social democratic leaders, especially Tanner, a true socialist and strong anti-communist who stoutly resisted Soviet pressure. According to Zenikov, the KGB resident in Helsinki in 1960, Soviet intelligence, with the active help of Khrushchev and other members of the Presidium, succeeded in the 1950s in recruiting a prominent Finnish social democrat. His KGB cryptonym was Leader. Zenikov was one of the KGB officers who maintained contact with him. At the KGB's suggestion, Leader argued in favor of a change in the social democratic attitude toward cooperation with the Soviet Union. Eventually, in 1959, he split away from the Social Democratic Party and formed his own party. The KGB provided him with guidance on the political attitudes and policies of this party. Other important recruitments were made in the Social Democratic leadership, and the agents concerned were used in intrigues against Tanner and Leskinen, but their identities are not known to the author. There were also successful Soviet efforts to recruit Finnish trade union leaders. In a conversation with the author, which took place in 1960, on the subject of removing anti-communists from the Social Democratic leadership, Zenikov said that it might be necessary to eliminate Leskinen physically by poisoning him. Zenikov said that he had an agent in the leadership of the Finnish Conservative Party who was in close touch with Leskinen and through whom the assassination could be arranged. Until the late 1950s, Soviet intelligence made use of agents in the Finnish Communist Party, including Pesi and Hertta Kuusinen, a communist member of parliament. In the period 1957-60, when the long-range policy was being formulated, the use by the KGB of agents in local communist parties was abandoned. At the same time, secret cooperation between the leaders of the CPSU and local communist parties was strengthened, the KGB acting under the guidance of the Central Committee when necessary to facilitate this cooperation. In the Finnish case, special groups were set up in the Central Committees of the Soviet and Finnish parties to handle the practicalities of coordination. The KGB resident in Helsinki acted as the link between the two groups. When Khrushchev visited Finland, Hertta Kuusinen was invited by the KGB resident to the Soviet embassy, where Khrushchev discussed with her the political lines her parliamentary statements should follow. The KGB and its residents in Finland, Kotov and Zenikov, played an important secret role through their agents in the election and formation of a series of Finnish governments. The KGB secretly coordinated the joint efforts of its agents and the Finnish Communist Party to muster support for those candidates who found favor with the Soviet Union and to mount campaigns against those who did not. Among the Soviet agents so used was the leader of the Swedish People's Party, who was handled by Ziegel and Zenikov. The main aim of these activities was to secure the election of a prominent Finnish leader, a KGB agent of long standing, whose cryptonym was Timo. Timo was recruited by Soviet intelligence in 1948, at which time he was a minister. The recruitment was achieved by a rank-and-file intelligence officer, a Soviet Finn from Karelia, who was serving undercover as second secretary in the Soviet embassy in Helsinki. This officer developed a close social relationship with Timo, which involved drinking bouts and saunas. He succeeded in persuading him that, in return for his collaboration with Soviet intelligence, the Soviets would forget the repressive action he had taken against communists in the past while serving as a high official and would use all their influence to build him up into a major political figure. The KGB resident at the time, Mikhail Kotov, sent Timo's recruiter back to Karelia and took for himself the credit for this spectacular success. From late in 1948 or early in 1949, Kotov in person maintained contact with Timo. Soviet intelligence kept their side of the bargain and threw all their weight behind his political career. Eventually, Timo achieved a high office and remained in it until recently. Soviet help for him took various forms, including diplomatic support for his policies, indirect financial support for his electoral campaigns, advice on the courses he should pursue, and help in undermining rival candidates. In 1961, Agent Leader, acting on KGB instructions, declared himself as a candidate for a high office in order, at a later stage, to transfer his supporters' votes to Timo. Timo, for his part, acted as a classic Soviet agent of influence. He promoted in his party those whom the Soviets wished to see promoted and, when possible, discussed his political appointments and decisions in advance with Soviet intelligence. For example, the Soviet government was consulted through the KGB in advance about his visit to the United States in 1961. He kept the KGB fully informed on his discussions with other Scandinavian leaders. On KGB advice, he created his own secret intelligence service under Vilkuna, another Soviet agent. Timo used the service to bolster his own power, and he shared its product with the KGB, which received all reports from Finnish ambassadors and military attachés abroad and secret information from other departments of the Finnish government. Timo, on KGB instructions, recommended the appointments of KGB agents as ambassadors to Moscow and other important posts. In 1960 and 1961, Zinnikov discussed with Timo the holding of the 8th World Festival of Youth in Finland in 1962. Timo promised to help arrange this, despite fierce opposition from large sections of the Finnish public. Meetings between Zinnikov and Timo took place at his brother's farm or in the Soviet embassy. When official receptions were held at the embassy, a special room was prepared in which private conversations with Timo could take place. Soviet government leaders, including Khrushchev and Brezhnev, were fully aware of Timo's relationship with the KGB when conversations and negotiations with Soviet leaders took place during his visits to Moscow. Kodov and Zinnikov would act as interpreters and advisors. Zinnikov often used to boast that he would get Timo secretly awarded the Order of Lenin. 8. Friction between Zinnikov and Zakharov, the ambassador to Finland. Over who should be responsible for maintaining and directing relations with Timo generated so much heat that both were summoned to appear before the Central Committee. The Central Committee's eventual decision was that Zinnikov should remain the principal contact with Timo, but that the ambassador should have the right to be consulted and to be present at meetings at which certain political matters were discussed. Zinnikov and Zakharov were warned by the Central Committee that if there were any further squabbles between them, both would be recalled to Moscow. In 1961, it was planned that Vladimirov should take over as KGB resident Horn Zinnikov and should assume responsibility for relations with Timo and for intelligence work in Finnish political parties in general. Kotov made a successful career in Soviet intelligence on the strength of his service in Finland. From being a Scandinavian specialist, he rose to the higher echelons of the KGB. Not long after Timo was appointed to a high office, Kotov was promoted to be a deputy chief of Soviet intelligence with responsibility for Austria and West Germany. In 1959 or 1960, he was summoned to a meeting of the Presidium at which Khrushchev congratulated him on his success in Finland and instructed him to apply his experience in Austria and Germany with a view to influencing the leaders of those countries in the direction of closer relations and eventual alliance with the Soviet Union. This illustration shows that the role of the KGB in what is now known as Finlandization can be a significant one. For the present purpose, it is more germane to see how, through agents of influence like Timo, the Soviets have been able to promote the strategy for Europe since 1958-60. Hurtigruten played an important role in the Scandinavian consultative body known as the Northern Council in promoting the idea of a nuclear-free zone in Scandinavia. She was also active in the 1960s in the Women's International Democratic Federation, WIDF, and became its chairman. By June 1963, pro-Soviet influence in the Social Democratic Party had reached a level at which Tanner, true to his anti-communist convictions, felt unable to accept the party chairmanship. According to the press, his successors, Paasio and Koivisto, developed close relations with both the Soviet government and party. In 1964, Simonen took over the leadership of the Social Democratic Union of Workers and Small Agrarians, SDS. In June, there were negotiations on a reconciliation of this splinter group with the main Social Democratic Party. In September, Simonen led a delegation to the Soviet Union that was received by Brezhnev and Andropov. 9. In 1967, Paasio, as chairman of the Social Democrats, and Simonen, as chairman of the SDS, both supported Timo for a high office. Paasio also came out against the U.S. bombing of North Vietnam. In 1968, Timo was reappointed to his high office. In May 1968, a delegation led by Paasio visited the Soviet Union for party negotiations with the CPSU and met Brezhnev, Suslov, and Ponomarev. The delegation highly esteemed the foreign policy carried out by the CPSU. Representatives of both the Social Democratic Party and SDS demanded the cessation of American bombing in Vietnam and agreed on the convening of a European Conference on Security. In June 1968, a conference of delegates from 15 countries took place in Helsinki. It concerned the recognition of East Germany and the implications this would have for European security. In the same month, Timo paid an unofficial visit to the Soviet Union. In October-November 1968, Koivisto, who had taken over the post of prime minister, paid a visit to Moscow. In connection with the possible extension of NATO to cover gray areas, Koivisto remarked in November 1968 that Finland had no enemies from whom to expect an invasion. The Great Soviet Encyclopedia recorded in 1969 that the Finnish Social Democratic Party fully cooperated on foreign policy with the Soviet Union. Perhaps Timo's greatest single service to communist strategy will turn out to be the help he gave in convening CSC in Helsinki. In 1969, the Finnish government agreed to act as host. During 1970, a Finnish ambassador was given a special assignment to visit the United States and Europe. In November of that year, the Finnish government addressed a note to 35 countries proposing a preparatory meeting on European security. In December, the Soviet Union agreed to the proposal. Similar agreement was expressed by all the East European states, including Yugoslavia, but not Albania. It is of particular interest that Timo visited the Soviet Union twice in 1970. In between the two visits to the Soviet Union, he visited the United States and discussed European security and the Middle East question. During his second visit to the Soviet Union, he said that the Soviet-Finnish Friendship Treaty of 1948 was of extreme significance for Finland, and he agreed to help prolong it for a further 20 years. The strategic role of the communist intelligence potential in Finland is known to the author in some detail up to the end of 1961 because he worked there. He also knows in general terms that similar activities were conducted in other European countries by KGB residents like Kroken and Rogoff, whose real name is Tsimbal, in France, Fedichkin, Orlov, and Gorshkov in Italy, and Korovin, an alias of General Rodin, in Britain. In West Germany, the KGB was particularly active and successful in blackmailing and recruiting two categories of politicians and officials, those who had bad records from the Nazi period and those who were known. From KGB penetration of other Western intelligence services to be working as agents for one or another of the Western powers. The exposure in April 1974 of Gunther Guillaume as an East German agent, which led to Brandt's resignation as chancellor, showed how far communist intelligence penetration had reached in West Germany. The author reported in 1962 that, in the previous September while serving in the KGB residency in Helsinki, he had read a highly classified circular letter from KGB headquarters to residencies abroad describing successful recruitments of important new agents in recent years, which should be emulated. One case, which was given as an example of a well-carried-out recruitment, illustrates the false flag recruitment technique. The circular said that in one of its residencies, the KGB had an agent. He was a very dependable, active agent who had been working for the KGB for many years and who had at one time been a minister in his country. He still had entree into political circles in that country and, in particular, was sufficiently close to the American and British ambassadors for both of them to visit him at home. His KGB controller asked him if he knew anyone who could be recruited in the Prime Minister's office. The agent replied that he did have a friend there, but that it would be difficult to approach him because he was a man of pro-Western views. It was therefore decided that, since the man knew that the agent was on friendly terms with the American and British ambassadors, the agent would ask him, ostensibly on behalf of one of them, for information on the Prime Minister's conversations. The agent did so, and his friend agreed to supply information. In due course, he accepted money in return. The circular said that in this way the residency had gained a new and valuable agent who began systematically to give information on the Prime Minister and his running of the country. The normal practice in such a case would be for the KGB to take over direct contact with an agent recruited under a false flag once he had been sucked in, but the circular did not say whether this had been done in this case. As far as the author knows, the agent and his friend have never been identified. At the end of 1961, the KGB was planning yet more active use of high-level agents of influence to manipulate world public opinion and the policies of individual governments. The KGB residencies abroad were instructed in 1961 to encourage its agents to attend the World Disarmament Conference in Moscow in 1962. No doubt the same instructions were repeated for other world peace congresses in the 1960s and 1970s. For Western security services, preoccupied in the main with conventional espionage, subversion, and law enforcement questions, the high-level agent of influence presents new and complex problems. Nevertheless, an understanding of communist strategy can help to throw new light on the significance of contacts made by communist embassies in the West and of visits by prominent Western citizens to the communist bloc. Undoubtedly, the bloc countries applied their intelligence potential to the service of communist strategy in the Third World as elsewhere. The author's information on the subject is fragmentary because the development of this potential was still in the early stages when he broke with the Soviet regime. Some general indications of the way in which things were moving were, for example, the creation of new African and Latin American departments in the KGB. The instruction to Soviet counterintelligence to establish direct personal contact with all Third World ambassadors in Moscow, the more intensive use, on Shelepin's instructions, of agents of influence for political purposes, and the use of anti-imperialist sentiment as the basis for recruiting agents. An additional general point is that KGB deputy residents with specific responsibility for Third World operations were appointed to important KGB residencies in the advanced countries, such as in the Washington and New York residencies. A KGB training manual that the author read in the late 1950s mentioned three specific cases, without giving full details. The first related to the president of a developing country who was recruited on a visit to the Soviet Union. Exceptionally, this recruitment was based partly on an indirect form of blackmail. The president was a homosexual. In approaching him, the KGB claimed to have information that a worldwide criminal organization had plans to blackmail him. The KGB offered to help him to avoid the blackmail in return for his cooperation against the imperialist powers. The president agreed to the proposal. The second case related to an Indian ambassador in Moscow, who performed important services for the KGB in exerting influence over other ambassadors in Moscow. The third case concerned an Indonesian ambassador in Moscow who was recruited. The training manual described two different ways in which information obtained from the penetration of Western intelligence services could be exploited. One was the doubling of Western agents whom the KGB had identified by penetration. The manual referred to a minister or deputy minister of internal affairs of an African country who was known from the penetration of British intelligence to be a British agent and who was blackmailed and recruited by the KGB on that basis. The alternative form of exploitation was to supply information to Third World leaders with whom the Soviets had close relations on the identities of Western agents in their countries. Information of this kind was given to Nasser in the late 1950s. The author learned of two specific recruitments from a former colleague, Sergei Antonov. In 1958 or 1959, Antonov, who was then KGB deputy resident at the United Nations in New York, recruited an important African personality. On the strength of this recruitment, Antonov was appointed head of the KGB's new African department in 1960. Vladimir Grusha, an official of the American department, recruited, in about 1957, a high-level Indonesian diplomat in the U.S. For this reason, Grusha, although a member of the American department, was posted as deputy resident in Indonesia in 1958 or 1959. Victor Ziegel, an official of the KGB residency in Helsinki, told the author that he had recruited a Brazilian diplomat in Finland in 1961. The agent's cryptonym was Pedro. While the author was working in the NATO section of the information department, the KGB obtained a memorandum written for NATO by a prominent Western Arabist on the use of Arab nationalism to divide the Arab world. The document was passed on to the Soviet leadership. In 1960, the KGB's decoding service broke the code used by the Turkish ambassador in Moscow and systematically read the messages passing between him and the Turkish Foreign Ministry. The traffic was known as Turkish Notebook. Mikhail Takach was a former Soviet military intelligence officer who spoke good Persian and English and had worked undercover as consul general in Iran, where he was known for his skill in recruiting Iranian officials. In 1956, Takach joined the KGB. In 1960, on Shelepin's instructions, he was appointed head of the International Department of the Soviet Trade Union Organization in order to reorientate it for political use, especially against the Third World. Takach told the author that all the officials of this department were members of the KGB. This gives some indication of the importance attached to the recruitment of foreign trade union officials, especially those from the Third World. That the security and intelligence potential of the Soviet National Republics was used in the interests of long-range policy is indicated by the appointment in the 1970s of Aliyev as first secretary of the party's Central Committee in Azerbaijan. He was once head of the counterintelligence department of the KGB branch in Azerbaijan, and after 1961 became chairman of the branch. His promotion can be explained only by the success of the KGB branch under his leadership in fulfilling party tasks. After he was made first secretary, he became active in the Third World. He has visited various Arab and African countries. There is evidence of advice and help being given by the Soviet Union and other members of the Communist bloc to friendly countries and liberation movements on intelligence, security, and guerrilla warfare. Recipients since 1960 have included Cuba, Ghana, up to 1966, and other African states. Strategic exploitation of KGB agents among prominent Soviet intellectuals and religious leaders. The KGB and its departments that are responsible for work among Soviet scientists and writers and foreign delegations and visitors to the USSR are involved in an active effort to influence prominent foreign visitors along desirable foreign strategy lines. Especially exploited are prominent personalities who are members of the Soviet Peace Committee, the Committee for Solidarity with African and Asian Countries, Soviet Friendship Societies, the State Committee of Science and Technology, the State Committee for Cultural Ties, and the Institute of USA and Canadian Studies, led by G. Arbatov. A special word needs to be said on the exploitation of religion and leading churchmen in the communist world for strategic political purposes. In November-December 1960, the Patriarch of All Russia, Alexei, an old KGB agent, accompanied by Metropolitan Nikodim, head of the Russian Orthodox Church's International Department, and Professor Uspensky of the Leningrad Faculty of Theology and an active member of the Soviet Peace Committee, toured the Middle East in an aircraft provided by the Soviet government. 12. In the course of the tour, Patriarch Alexei and the Syrian Patriarch issued an official communique that stated, "Our standpoint of Christian love compels us to condemn everything which incites hatred among peoples and impels mankind toward a new world war, and to bless any attempts aimed at creating peace between peoples and nations. We resolutely condemn any manifestation of colonialism as foreign to the spirit and the letter of the law of God." 13. The real identity of Metropolitan Nikodim is an interesting question. According to official sources, he was appointed head of the International Department of the Russian Orthodox Church in 1960. Having served from 1957 to 1959 as a priest in the Russian Orthodox Church in Jerusalem, a colleague of the author's at the KGB Institute named Lashin was appointed, on graduation from the Institute, to the religious section of the KGB's Emigre Department, where he was working in 1960. Lashin told the author that the KGB had succeeded in placing the deputy head of the Emigre Department, who was responsible for religious affairs, undercover as head of the International Department of the Russian Orthodox Church. The KGB officer concerned, who used the name Veryukin in the KGB, had served as a priest in Jerusalem in 1957-58. He had earlier made a significant contribution to the KGB's penetration of the church and the persecution of its priests. He had been transferred abroad to specialize in other churches, using his KGB connections and facilities for political purposes. Lapshin himself was being prepared to serve in the United States undercover as the editor of a religious publication. His mission was probably canceled because the author's connection with Lapshin would have been known to the KGB. Metropolitan Nikolai Krititsky, who Nikodim replaced as head of the International Department, though a true priest, was an old KGB agent. His replacement by Nikodim may well have been due to the fact that Krititsky's association with the KGB was exposed by the former Soviet intelligence officer Duryabin in 1957. The Christian Peace Conference, composed of East European church leaders, dates from the period of the formulation of the long-range policy. It has played an active part in influencing Western churches in the interests of that policy. The Second All-Christian Congress in Defense of Peace, held in Prague in June-July 1964, attracted 1,000 delegates, including representatives of Buddhism and Islam, as well as the Orthodox, Catholic, and the Anglican and other Protestant churches. The introductory speech was made by Gromadka of Czechoslovakia, the president of the Christian Peace Conference. Speakers from the Third World included one from Madagascar and one from Uruguay. The Congress appealed to all Christians for disarmament, independence, and the eradication of hunger. In November-December 1964, the 7th General Conference of the International Brotherhood of Buddhists, held in India, was attended by Buddhists from the Soviet Union. Mongolian, as well as Soviet, Buddhists went to a Buddhist conference in Ceylon in 1969. It was decided to hold a forum of Asian Buddhists in June 1970 to discuss the struggle for peace and support for North Vietnam. 14. The forum took place in Mongolia. 15. 2 months later, a central Buddhist monastery and a Buddhist institute were opened in Ulan Bator. In March 1965, the first conference of Muslims of Asia and Africa was held in Bandung. 35 countries were represented. The Mufti of Central Asia and Kazakhstan, Babakanov, led the Soviet delegation. The conference discussed the use of Muslim proselytizing societies as weapons against imperialism. The need to harness Islam to the service of the revolution has been openly discussed by communist strategists. Based on Soviet experience in Central Asia, the problem of achieving this is considered difficult but soluble. Point 16. The Christian Peace Conference held a seminar in Sofia in June 1976 to discuss the outcome of CSC in Helsinki and its significance for the Third World. The main reports were introduced by Professor Bogner, the head of the Research Institute of World Economy of Budapest University, by Dr. Kutsenkov, deputy director of the Institute of International Labor Movements of the Soviet Academy of Sciences, and by professors from India and Puerto Rico. The theme of the seminar was that the Third World, which had been exploited by imperialism in the past, should welcome the Helsinki Conference and recognize the need for cooperation in the European collective security process. Dynamic steps should be taken to ensure military détente and disarmament, which would allow Europe to contribute to the new economic order. Helsinki had not destroyed the forces opposed to détente or frustrated their anti-communist purposes. Further efforts were necessary to prevent new forms of psychological warfare by the enemies of peace. 17. The seminar was followed by discussions in Moscow between Metropolitan Nicodem and delegations from Pax Christi and churches in Italy, Holland, Belgium, and West Germany. The subject was East and West now and tomorrow from the Christian point of view. The meeting welcomed the Helsinki agreements and underlined the importance of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and the negotiations in Vienna for troop reductions in Central Europe. The secretary of the International Department of the Russian Church, Baevsky, drew a distinction between communist and Western aid to the Third World by maintaining that communist aid was given to develop Third World economies toward independence. The Soviet professor Osipov said that East-West collaboration resulting from Helsinki would allow the diversion of military budgets to the development of the Third World. He drew attention to the importance of the UN General Assembly's call in 1974 for a new economic order. The Great Soviet Encyclopedia recorded that by 1972 the World Council of Churches had been converted from a pro-Western to a progressive orientation in its policies on peace, disarmament, and related matters. Assiduous advocacy by the Christian Peace Conference and others of the view that Christianity and communism were natural allies in support of the National Liberation Movement induced the World Council of Churches to provide funds for African guerrilla movements, including the Rhodesian Patriotic Front, believed to be responsible for a massacre of British missionaries in 1978. The Fifth General Conference of Buddhists for Peace was held in Ulaanbaatar in July 1979. The Patriarch of All Russia, Pimen, sent a message to his dear fellow friends of peace, wishing them success. In the previous month, he had received the Dalai Lama, who was in Moscow on his way to Ulaanbaatar, and no doubt shared with him his experience of peace conferences. The Patriarch's message to the conference was conveyed by Metropolitan Nicodem's successor, Metropolitan Yuvanoly, who had acted as chairman of an all-world conference held in Moscow in 1977 on religious leaders for peace, disarmament, and just relations between peoples. Yuvanoly advocated signature of the SALT II Treaty and the opening of negotiations on SALT III, arguing that only détente could bring peace to the whole world, including Asia.